McLaren is a Formula One team with incredible heritage. The cars driven by Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri today have the same championship-winning DNA that has permeated through the team's race cars for more than 60 years. And that is thanks to people like Neil Oatley.
McLaren have won the Constructors' Championship in Australia, just as they won the Drivers' Championship with Ayrton Senna in Japan. A magnificent season for McLaren. There are their happy mechanics pouring out of the garage onto the pit lane to greet their man home. Constructors' Championship for McLaren, Drivers' Championship for Mika Häkkinen.
Without those hard working hours for the people in the factory, for the designers, we still wouldn't be winners. But because there has been such a hard work for everybody, here we are, we won the championship.
Neil is one of the most humble and influential F1 engineers of all time. A world champion designer who won with Williams and then won more with McLaren. In his 45-year career, he's worked with the greatest racers and experienced the fiercest rivalries. None more iconic than Alain Prost and Ayrton Senna.
He was taking things to a different level compared to what Alan had been used to. I mean, Alan was still in the mode where he'd, Saturday afternoon, after qualifying, he'd be off in the golf course with Jacques Lafitte, whereas Ayrton would be locked in the truck with the Honda engineers trying to work out how he could make the engine response better or more drivable, etc. So it just started to bring things into a different level.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. I'm Tom Clarkson, and this episode is truly special. Neil Oatley is one of F1's ultimate behind-the-scenes heroes. All the way back in the late 1970s, he race-engineered the first Grand Prix-winning Williams, and his genius car setups helped the team to its first world titles. At McLaren, winning was not just required, it was expected. After all, the team won every race but one in 1988. In 89, Neil had a front row seat as intra-team tensions boiled over, and in the following decade, he delivered huge success. Senna, Prost and Mika Häkkinen all won world titles in cars that he designed. And incredibly, Neil is still at the cutting edge of F1. As McLaren's Director of Design and Development, his world-beating wisdom helps to create the cars driven by Norris and Piastri today. Neil's unassuming, he doesn't like to shout about his achievements, but he talks me through the most memorable highlights from his stellar career. He explains how the sport has evolved for both driver and engineer during his time. Plus, you won't want to miss his fascinating insight into what it was like to witness firsthand Prost and Senna's intense rivalry. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, Neil, 45 years in the business and you're still at the coalface with McLaren. You're an unstoppable force.
Yeah, it's still very enjoyable. You know, I still love the sport and it's great to still be able to have some involvement.
Well, tell us about 2023, actually, because it's been reported in the media that you really are back working on the MCL60. What's the job?
To be honest, it's only a very part-time job, so I've still got a number of other roles which I'm doing, so this is only just a small part of my time, really. But it's just to help mentor and take the load off some of the other key players in the restructured organisation, so Andrea, Neil, Peter and David when he arrives later or the end of this year. Just trying to help where I can without being oppressive in my involvement.
With so much experience, just give us your thoughts on the 2023 cars, because if we take Red Bull and Aston Martin actually out of the equation, we're seeing huge fluctuations in performance from race to race across the rest of the grid. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think the two cars you mentioned are fairly neutral cars and that they don't have many bad points, whereas I think the rest of us have got small problems with cars being inconsistent from different types of corner to another, different speeds. Modern Formula One cars are incredibly difficult to drive. They're very sensitive to steering, ride heights, etc. And some people have got the equation exactly right and others are still struggling a little bit.
And actually, you talk about driving. Would love to get your thoughts on Lando Norris, Oscar Piastri. You've worked with so many drivers, many of which we're going to come to in a minute. But what are your thoughts on Lando and Oscar?
I mean, both wonderful kids, really. I mean, calling them kids because I'm so old myself, but I think they've both grown up through motorsport for a long period of their lives, and they're very attuned to what the modern driver has to do. Is much more of a scientist than the drivers were 45 years ago. So their ability to pick up on data, learn from it, being able to properly adjust themselves to try and make the best out of the equipment they've got in front of them.
Neil, that's fascinating how the job of being a racing driver has changed since 1977 when you first joined Williams. What do you mean by they're more scientific now?
I couldn't imagine Alan Jones spending hours in the evening poring over the data from the day's running or even sitting in a simulator. So it's a different type of application and a different mindset, I think, of the drivers. But the modern guys, and particularly the younger ones like Lando and Oscar, that's all they've known. It's been there right from the beginning of their motorsport careers, and they're able to adapt, play with their gaming stations and what have you, and use our simulator to improve their techniques and optimise what they've got.
But do you think a fast racing driver is a fast racing driver across all eras? So could Lando be quick in an FW07? Equally, could Carlos Reutemann or Alan Jones be quick in a modern car with enough practice?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think the individuals are very different characters. I think the skill sets aren't the same, so it may not naturally translate across such a wide period of time.
Okay, so if the drivers don't translate, what about the job of making a car go fast, right? I mean, you know, you have experience of ground effect from 40 years ago. How applicable is that on these modern cars?
It's very addictive, I think, in the ground effect days back in the late 70s and early 80s, we had sliding skirts or fixed length skirts that allowed you to make more changes more easily. I mean, they produce a phenomenal amount of downforce, but a development would make a half a single lap difference. Now you're making half a tenth difference on the development. So it's a whole different ball game, really. And it's very good for the aerodynamicists to be able to have the freedom to develop their own ideas and apply them to a car almost straight away.
So is modern F1 more evolution rather than revolution?
Very much so. There's a huge amount of work goes on in CFD and in the wind tunnels to chip away at very, very small differences and understand them, whereas it was big chunks back all that time ago.
Now, Neil, you've been a race engineer, you've been a designer. There isn't a bit of a racing car that you don't know after your experience in the sport. What would you say has been your particular area of expertise?
I'm more of a mechanical engineer than an aerodynamicist. And that's really how my education and early career evolved, I think. So having my time again, I might have taken a different route from what I know now, but I think that's sort of served me reasonably well. And I've been lucky enough to be surrounded by so many good people, good engineers, that it all rubs off on you and you're able to absorb the knowledge from the other people have gained and apply it yourself. So I've shared the room with a lot of very talented people.
You certainly have. But what about your own motivation? Is it born out of a desire to win? Is it born out of a desire to find new avenues?
Yeah, I think everyone in the sport has got a strong desire to win. I mean, losing's really awful. In fact, that plays on your mind more than the wins do, I think. A win, you know, you put it away and it's the next day you've forgotten about it, but the losses are actually far more important than learning from them and going forwards. I mean, I started off as a young kid who loved racing cars, and it's my career sort of followed the pre-planned path, which not many people are lucky enough to have had happen to them.
You've won 9 drivers' titles, 7 constructors' titles. What means more to you, a driver winning the championship or the team winning the championship?
I think that's very blurred. I think everyone remembers who won the Drivers' Championship, but very few people remember who won the Constructors' Championship. I think the politically correct thing to say would be the Constructors' Championship, but I think that in reality that's not really the case. And I think you need your driver to win the Drivers' Championship, and that's really the most important thing.
Except, Neil, I beg to differ, because Frank and Patrick always told us in the media anyway that the Constructors' Championship is where it was at. And I think some of the drivers, like Damon, will tell you, yeah, he sort of felt that the team championship was more important to them as well.
I think if you asked that Patrick, to be honest now, he'd say the same as what I did.
Okay.
I'm slightly guessing there.
Let's now wind it back and have a look at your career in detail. And we're going to go back to the beginning, to 1977. You join Williams. I think you're employee number 13, if I've got that right.
That's correct, yeah.
Patrick Head was your first technical boss. How instrumental was he? How influential was he on you?
Oh, tremendously so. And I'd have to say, I owe my career to Patrick and Frank as well. I mean, both fairly mercurial characters. But when I joined Williams, Patrick was the only other engineer there. And I was a fairly short time out of university and very green in engineering terms. And I just learned so much from him. And he was such a good mentor and a superb person to work from. And I couldn't have landed in a better place, I think, to develop myself as a person and an engineer.
What was the biggest thing Patrick taught you?
Making a practical car, but a fast car, and joining those things together. I think the FW07 was a good example of that. I mean, it really took on the ideas of the Lotus 79, particularly, Lotus 78 slightly, but engineered it in a much better way, so it's more successful. And I think when everyone caught up with Lotus in 1979, the deficiencies of their car, because it just wasn't very nicely engineered, became fairly evident, and people overtook them and made much faster vehicles.
And how quickly did Patrick give you responsibility in the design office?
Fairly quickly, because he had no other choice.
Needs must.
Yeah, I mean, Frank Durney arrived after a year or so, year and a quarter perhaps, to boost the office. But no, it was a fantastic period to learn. The FW06, which was just being started when I arrived, was a relatively simple car. It was typical mid-70s vehicle. But I joined in early September, and the car was running in December. And that was from nothing, because they were running a March 761 prior to that. So there was not much around when we used the March wing, probably, and things like that. But it all came together very quickly, and super place to learn.
And talking about the aerodynamics of the FW07, how much time were you spending in the wind tunnel, and how much of it was just on a drawing board?
Very little wind tunnel time. I think the FW06 never went in the wind tunnel until we actually started to develop as a baseline for the FW07. But we used the Imperial College wind tunnel in London. And I think we went there maybe once a month for a few days. And that slowly increased. Then we bought the wind tunnel from Specialised Mouldings up in Huntingdon and installed that in another building in Didcot. And actually Ross Braun was responsible for the installation of that. And that allowed us to sort of test all the time in-house. So that was a big step forward.
I find it fascinating when you say the FW06 didn't go in a wind tunnel. So how do you decide upon the shape of the car?
I mean, that's all Patrick's work, and it was his intuition, really, and what he'd learnt through his brief phrase with Wolf, which was fairly short, but at Lola prior to that. And he designed a Formula 2 car for Richard Scott and a Formula 42,000 car for Delta. So he'd been absorbing that knowledge and learning from what other people were doing.
But how interesting that 06 didn't go in the wind tunnel. 07 did. Yes, and it looked a bit different. But actually, Patrick's gut direction of how to make the car look wasn't wrong.
No, it was perfect. We did initial test at Donington, and it had a few slight quirks going over brows, and Patrick thought he'd sort of screwed it up, but in fact he hadn't, and it just took a little bit of tuning to get the car right, and it was very quick straight away. I mean, unfortunately, it arrived a few races into the season and was a little bit unreliable for the first couple of events. So I think if we'd got it ready a little bit earlier, it probably would have won the championship, because it was certainly a lot better car than the Ferrari was that year.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. So the wins start coming at Silverstone in 1979. You are, as well as doing everything in the design, or not everything, but working in the design office, you are race engineering Clay Regazzoni. It's the first of Williams' 114 wins. What are your memories of that Silverstone weekend?
It was a great day, particularly for Frank, who'd been trying for such a long time. It's probably the only time in my life I ever saw him drink any alcohol or smoke a cigar. The car had been very quick in testing. Frank had come up with some different aerodynamic pieces in the pre-Grand Prix test, and then the car had made a big step forward. Also, we traditionally viewed Silverstone as a high-speed, low-downforce circuit, so we were running small wings, but we actually tried putting them a bit slightly bigger wing on in the test, and that suddenly made the car really come alive. So a lot of the performance game was with the wing working better in reaction to the underwing of the car. So the car was pretty special by the time we raced at Silverstone. But we were up against the turbo cars, who were obviously very quick. Because those days, you didn't have TV monitors on the screen. I didn't actually realise that Clay had actually led half of the first lap until I saw it a few years ago. Because you're never aware of that thing. But we were slightly fortunate because some of the turbo cars had unreliability. And obviously, Alan was actually competing very well, but had a small crack in a water pump, and which leaked all the water out and lost him the race, basically. So,
and how nervous were you at that point that Clay wasn't going to make it to the end?
I'm always nervous in races. I think it's always a terrible situation when you're leading the race by a long way, and all you think about is what could go wrong. and again, because you didn't have TVs, you had to wait until the car came into view every lap and to know it was still running. But it was leading quite comfortably for over half the race, I think. And it was a long day, actually. These last few laps took a long time to happen.
Obviously, it gave Frank the credibility that he'd been craving for the last sort of 10 years. But how did you feel about that win?
Glad it happened, but I think you only remember the wins in a small way, and you remember the losses really ease away at you. So I think, the next day you're moving on to the next thing, so it doesn't really stay with you that so long.
But it was the start, if you like, of an incredible end of the year. I think you won 5 of the last 7 races as a team. How did that change the atmosphere inside Williams?
A lot. And as you say, Frank had been struggling from 1969 to actually put together a really good racing team in the season. And suddenly we became the team to beat. And over a very short, that almost happened within 12 months. It went from almost nothing to an incredibly successful team. So it did buoy up everyone. It made it easier to recruit people. And the team expanded quite rapidly after that. Allowed us to get sponsors, most importantly, to much more easily. Obviously, Mansur OJ came on board in that period. And it was a wonderful time to sort of very rapid expansion. And it was all handled very well. I think it was very easy to lose sense of yourself if you're expanding too quickly. But it was all done in a very appropriate way, I think, and we moved forward.
And how much confidence did you have going into 1980, having had that domination, I think we can call it, of the second half of 79?
I think we were very confident. Obviously, you're always worried that other people will quickly catch up. And obviously, it was fairly competitive that year. But Alan was on the top of his form. Carlos joined the team that year, and we had a sort of very strong pairing between the two of them for those following 2 years.
The FW07 ended up doing 3 seasons. How did you tweak it from one to the next?
I think 79 to 80 was a sort of an evolution. It wasn't a massive change. Obviously, there were some regulation changes for 81, which got a bit complicated with the right height rules and so on, and how people were bypassing them. So that was probably more a significant change for 81. Also, we had a fairly unusual step where we switched from Michelin to Goodyear tyres in mid-season, which would be unthinkable now.
Why did you do that? That seems an extraordinary thing.
Frank was a big fan of the USA and American business, and he thought American muscle would prevail over the small French company from Clermont. And that did cause us some problems. I think the tyres had very different characteristics, and we didn't respond probably as quickly as Brabham did in adjusting the car to suit the different tyres. Carlos was completely dismayed by the change, and I think if you look back, he scored probably 3/4 of his points with the Michelin car then compared to the Goodyear car.
The chequered flag holder is out. I can see the flag of Saudia and the British Union Jack, and Alan Jones takes that Union Jack to win the Caesars Palace Grand Prix. That there is the world champion, actually becoming world champion of 1981. 5th position, Nelson Piquet, ahead of Carlos Reutemann. The end of an exciting and well worth it Caesars Palace Grand Prix of 1981.
Las Vegas 81. I did want to ask you about this race. It's the season decider. Carlos goes into the race at Caesars Palace 1 point in the lead of the world championship. He qualifies on pole, yet he finishes 8th Piquet wins the championship by a point. What happened there? What happened in that race?
I'm glad you brought up that pain.
Sorry. There will be lots of good moments later on.
I mean, a championship's never won or lost in one race, but obviously that is the focal point of that season. As you say, the car was quick in practice. Carlos qualified on pole. In warm-up on Sunday, we had a problem with his race car. The engine had a very slight misfire, and we couldn't actually find out what was causing that. So we felt it was too big a risk to race that engine, and we didn't feel we had enough time to properly swap the engines over. So he went into his T car, which he'd used during the it was actually 3 days of practice that year. And he was never quite as comfortable in the T car as he was in the race car. I mean, we weren't as adept at making all the cars the same as we are would be now back in that time. So the T car wasn't as good a car as the race car for whatever reason, unknown. Carlos said the gear shift was bad, but we stripped it down, couldn't find anything wrong. There's no damage to the gear, so I don't know. And we set up the car, which is my fault entirely, fairly stiff, which was quick on the one lap in practice, and it may have been an error and then not been quick for the whole Grand Prix length. So that all those factors together, Carlos may have, you know, his crowning glory was there for grabbing, and sometimes people do choke a little bit. I don't know.
But what was his mood at lunchtime on Sunday?
Not good.
Yeah.
No, he was very unconfident that he was convinced everything was to go wrong, and sure enough it did. But
so, Neil, even back then, you know, I'm told by race engineers now that part of their job is not, they're not psychologists, but working with the drivers, helping them feel confident. Were you having to do that day with Carlos?
I was trying to, and I think looking back, I probably didn't do a very good job of it, and I'd take more of the blame than Carlos for not winning in that event. It you know, is a recurring nightmare, really. But I think when you look back, you always think of things you could have done better. I think as a team, we didn't. Massage, Frank and Patrick were definitely not people for putting their arm around drivers and trying to make them feel better. And that's what Carlos needed. I think he was always convinced that Frank and Patrick didn't want him to win and would much prefer Alan taking the laurels at all the races, so, which was far from the truth. So I think all those things combined together just tipped the scales in the wrong way on that day.
What was Carlos's greatest strength as a driver?
He was tremendously quick when everything was pointing in the right direction. He thought about racing a lot, and I think going back to an earlier question, he would have loved today and having that data available. And if he was sat here today, sadly he isn't, he could probably tell you what gear race he was running at every track. But he used to do some strange things, like he'd go out on a Friday practice and he'd be running at 20 seconds, 30 seconds off the pace, and Patrick would be going absolutely livid and shouting at me on the pit wall. But what he would do is split the circuit into three sections, drive flat out through the first section, then slow down, think about it while he's going around the rest of the lap, do it again, get it right, then move on to the next section, and then the third section. And then eventually on lap 9 or 10, he would put it all together and do a blisteringly quick lap. So very strange character in many ways, but a lovely gentleman.
So after the disappointment of Vegas, we go into 1982. Carlos is still at the team. He finishes on the podium at the first race of that season. How surprised were you that he just gave it up after two races and retired?
I mean, it came completely out of the blue to me.
There was no mention of it at the racetrack?
No, absolutely none.
And you felt that he was still as committed and as quick in the car?
Yeah, and he was very quick. I mean, obviously, Keke joined the team that year and was very quick. Keke had tremendous car control, so his athletic ability to drive a car quickly was tremendous. And maybe Carlos was put off by that and thinking that Keke would become another Alan Jones, as Frank and Patrick's favourite in his mind. So I don't know. I didn't really see him after he retired and for many, many years.
Carlos drove the Ferrari at the Argentine Grand Prix in the mid-90s. I can't remember exactly which year. Maybe it was 95, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I was there.
And it was wet.
Yeah.
And he got in it and gave it full beans straight away. I was incredibly impressed.
Yeah, no, he wasn't that far off the pace of the actual race drivers, I think. And he'd been in the garage sort of going through all my notes of
how to
what gear they were using on each corner and such like, so he could apply that when he drove the Ferrari, don't you?
Now, Neil, I know that Alan Jones was predominantly on the other side of the garage, but the teams were so small back then. I'm sure you got a feel for what Jonesy was doing that was impressive. And of course, you then worked with him at Beatrice a few years later. What was it about Alan Jones that made him so impressive?
I mean, he was an incredibly tough racer. No, he wouldn't take any prisoners on the circuit, as probably Nelson found out a couple of times. Yeah, he was a tremendous racer. He'd just report back exactly what the car was doing, and then that's your problem, sort it out, and he'll go away and do something else. And so he's very, very straightforward. His ability to drive were quite physical cars at that time. No, they're producing a lot of downforce. You need to be fairly strong to even just sort of turn the wheel in the high speed corners. So I think those cars suited him. He was brave, which again, and you had to have the commitment to drive the car very quickly. So I think that time and that period of car absolutely suited his personality and abilities.
How had he changed as a driver, if at all, by the time you then worked together at Beatrice?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it was really the best idea to come back. I think in the first place, he retired too early. I think he sort of exhausted himself after 81 and just didn't want to go through it all again. And I think he got fed up with grey, miserable days in Putney rather than the sort of sunny climbs down under. But I think he would have been better if he'd just stayed on another couple of years and then made a cleaner break of it.
It was certainly reported in the media that Jones and Reutemann were bickering, they weren't getting on. Do you think he found that exhausting as well?
No, I think it's water off a duck's back to him. I mean, after Brazil in 81, he didn't really take any notice of Carlos. There wasn't any bickering at all. I think that was obvious to me anyway. Yeah.
And if there's one drive that stood out, either from Jones or Reutemann?
There were many of them. I think one thing that sticks in my mind, which actually wasn't the race, but it was Carlos's qualifying lap in Monza in 1981. Yeah, in a DFE car against the turbos. And no, the car was absolutely perfectly balanced. We'd actually done a test at Monza a couple of weeks beforehand. And as it was August, the stands were full of Italians on holiday. And but we were the only team there. So, and we did one day with each driver. And I had this massive list of things I wanted to try on the car. And so we moved our pit to the pit entrance. And Carlos would go out, do one time lap, hit the brakes, do a U-turn on the main straight, come back in the pit, we do the quick change and off he'd go. And we did that the whole day. So we probably saved about 30 laps, but we went through this matrix of different setups and honed in on something that was really good. So we ran a really minimum wing level and the car was absolutely perfectly balanced. So and that translated directly to the race. But while we sat on the grid, it started to drizzle slightly and that Carlos completely lost his confidence. Because the car was actually on a knife edge, but he could control it in the drive. But he just wasn't comfortable in the damp conditions. And Alan, a couple of days before, had a fight with a transit driver in the Putney High Street, had broken his finger. But he still managed to beat Carlos in the race. So that was a good qualifying for the bad race.
So look, final thoughts on Williams. How quickly was Formula One changing at this time in terms of how you were designing things back in 77 versus almost a decade later? Was the process different? And also, are there any particular innovations from that time that you're especially proud of?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm proud of that much I've done, but the process has evolved a lot. Obviously, as we mentioned earlier, the wind tunnels became more of a force, and at Williams we had our own one, and that made a big difference to be able to do things in-house. Data didn't really... It started becoming important during the turbo era, mainly for engine data, and it probably wasn't until early 90s that we started to do a lot of data recording for chassis sides, and that opened up sort of new avenues of learning about the car and correlating the aerodynamic performance on the track compared to what we're looking at in the wind tunnel. And it's all moved on a lot now with CFD and what have you. So
why do you think it worked so well between Frank and Patrick?
I mean, they were very different but very matched characters, and I think they had their strong points and weak points complemented one another, so it became an entity that was able to drive that team along. And it was in the days where the teams were still quite small, so that two individuals will have a far more effect than perhaps they would do nowadays. I mean, both fantastic people to work with. I mean, they're both such a big influence on my life, really, from all that time ago.
What was Patrick's reaction when you said to him, I've loved my time here, but I'm actually moving to what is effectively a startup Formula One team? in Beatrice.
Yes, it was, and he was very disappointed, to say the least, but I think he could understand it. I mean, my motivation was that I'd learned a huge amount from Patrick and did feel very guilty about taking that knowledge away with me, but I felt I'd sort of worked with him for such a long time and learned so much that I wasn't sure about my own abilities, and I wanted to just prove whether I could work without that safety net of Patrick standing over me, being able to correct any silly errors or bad decisions I made.
So tell us about the team. So Carl Haas, an IndyCar, North American racing legend, wanted to come and do Formula One. He had a good sponsor in Beatrice. He had Ford on board. And when you think of the talent that he had in that team, and I'm thinking of you, I'm thinking of Ross Brawn. I know Adrian Newey came on a little bit later. You had Alan Jones driving one of the cars. On paper, it looked unstoppable. What was the reality?
It had the basis of a very good team, obviously. As you say, it was starting from scratch or evolved out of the Mayer Motor Racing IndyCar team, which Teddy and Tyler had been running. Had quite a few old McLaren people from the 70s who were very experienced and all very good people at their own areas. And I think if we'd had another year, I think it would have all come together. But we struggled a bit. The Cosworth engine was new for that year, and that was still a learning process. And I think it wasn't particularly powerful or advanced as some of the other teams to start with. And by August, Ford had decided that they'd rather give the engine to Benetton the following year, which is part of the reason why it fell over. And so it didn't really evolve very much with us. I remember they let Patrick have a special engine in morning warm-up at Monza, which had a lot more capable of running a lot more boost, and it was like 50 miles an hour quicker than Alan and very quick. But then it blew up before the end of warm-up, so it wasn't actually raced. And then that was the last we saw of it. So Alan wasn't shy at criticising either Ford or Cosworth, and I think the whole thing sort of spiralled a bit. And then Beatrice disappeared, and Carl wasn't that committed to keeping the F1 team going.
How frustrating was all that for you?
Very exact. I think there's a lot of really good people there. And you say Adrian had arrived probably in July or August of that year, so he was already working on a design for the following year's car.
Do you think the writing was already on the wall at that point, though, that actually it was dead in the water for the next year?
It was looking a little bit. I think by September it became obvious that it wasn't going to be straightforward if we'd carry on or not, and it fairly quickly disappeared. So, so when we got back from Australia, it was locking the door and going off to pastures new.
And Neil, what were you thinking at this point in terms of your career and what to do next?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it until things started looking a bit dodgy, and almost by incredible coincidence, I got an approach from McLaren almost exactly the same time, so there wasn't really a long period where I was really wondering what the hell I was going to do in the futures.
The commitment to stay in motorsport, you didn't want to suddenly start designing road cars. You knew that you wanted to stay in Formula One, did you consider a move to IndyCar? Or?
No, Formula One's always been my primary love of in racing, and competition cars have really where I've always wanted to do. I didn't really have any desires to work in road cars or such like. So luckily, things have allowed me to do that for quite a long period of time.
So you get an offer from McLaren, and it seems that Ron Dennis was building a bit of a super team back then, because you join at what seemed to be roughly the same time as Gordon Murray. Ron was desperately trying to lure Ayrton Senna to the team to join Alain Prost. It must have felt a really exciting place to be when you first turned up in Woking.
To be honest, at the time I didn't know that Gordon was coming to the team. I'd actually agreed with Ron some terms, and I actually went round to his house to sign the contract, and Gordon opened the door. So that was my first inkling.
Oh, wow, really? I didn't realise that. Okay.
Anyway, things carried on, and the team was obviously very good. I mean, John Barnard had already departed just prior to that, but the team of guys that were already here were tremendously talented individuals, and that was a really strong, small team, but a really strong engineering team.
And how did you rub along with the Gordon Murrays and the Steve Nichols?
Very well. I didn't really have any problems with any of them. I mean, all the guys that were here were sort of very straightforward characters. There was no sort of big egos in the way. We were just building the what was then the new factory in Woking to move into, and Gordon was reasonably preoccupied with sorting that out. So the rest of his engineers were sort of left very much to their own devices. And in fact, for the first three or four months I was there, we were working in the very old McLaren factory and everybody else was in the new one. So we had to sort of do a half-mile trip to speak to anyone else. But it all worked out quite well, I think.
And so which was the first car that you started working on?
It would have been MP4-3. I mean, that was primarily... That was well advanced by the time I got there, so I only did a few trivial bits and pieces for it, to be honest. And my role was going to be working on the first V10 Honda car. So I left Steve and carry on with what he was doing.
So in the design office, you were focused on MP4-5 for 1989, but then practically at the track, you were race engineering Alain Prost. Have I got that right?
Yeah, so you could do a day job on the drawing board and then go off for the weekend being a race engineer and then come back on Monday morning and carry on with the design work. So that's really exactly how it worked. And so Steve kept on developing the MP4-3 and MP4-4 while I was working on we did the test car for the V10 and then the proper race car for the following season.
We'll come on to the 89 car, but can we talk about that 88 season, that incredible year where McLaren won all but one race and Senna and Prost were hammer and tongs every weekend. What was it like to be in the garage at that time working with Alain?
It was good. I mean, there wasn't really a lot of attention, particularly in 88. That was fairly friendly atmosphere. Obviously, it changed a little bit after Imola in 89. So I'd worked with Alain the previous year on the MP4-3. And literally the first time I ever met Alain was actually for the Brazilian Grand Prix that year. The flight was delayed going out there, so we didn't arrive until Thursday night. So the first time I met him was actually...
Almost
just before P1. anyway, just going on the side. But
Alain Prost was known as Le Professor. You know, having worked with him, did he warrant that? What was he incredibly detailed in the technical side of things?
Obviously, he learned a lot, I think, from Nicky in the couple of years together. Alain was very focused on making a good racing car rather than a good qualifying car. So everyone likes to be on pole position, but that wasn't so important to him. And he was just focused on getting a good race car. I mean, it's very interesting that in that first year, the whole team was very much focused on Alain. And,
in 87,
right? 87, yeah. And Stefan was sort of over there somewhere. When Ayrton arrived in 88, you can notice a big shift, and then suddenly it was just me plugged into to Alain. So the team had always decided, I think, where their future lay as early as that.
How early in that 88 season did you realise you had a rocket ship?
The first run the car did on the track, I think. I was at Imola with the MP4-3, but which we converted to run Honda engines. So we'd been doing 2 or 3 days with both Ayrton and Alain. And the MP4-4 was very late getting finished, and it literally arrived the night before the last day of the test. So we only had one day's testing before we went to Brazil. But the first, we did the installation lap, and then the first proper run, it was probably at least the second half quicker than the old car had been. It may have been 2 seconds. So it was just instantly, it was just so much faster than the old car.
Who drove it first?
Alain. And then, yeah, there was a bit of argument about who. I think Alain was convinced that he should focus on that car the whole day and Ayrton just drive it in Brazil. But anyway, they did half a day each.
And it was a rocket ship from that moment. Can you remember what Prost's first words to you were when he got back to the pits?
I think it was something like, oh, we can win the championship in this car, no problem.
Did he really say that?
Yeah.
Wow. And then what is it like to ride that crest of a wave where you go into every weekend knowing that you should win that Grand Prix, one of you?
Yeah, I think as I mentioned earlier, you're in a race, you're always worried about breaking down when you're in a really fairly invulnerable position. It's that's the only concern. But I think we were lucky both that year and the year after. We knew one of our two drivers was certainly going to win the world championship. So that created a sort of different dynamic than it would have been if we'd been in a big fight with other teams as well. So things evolved quite differently, I think.
You've been involved in so many championship battles over the years. What's harder for a team, an intra-team battle between your two drivers or an inter-team battle where one of your guys is fighting someone from another team?
Well, I'd say definitely fighting another team, because it's your responsibility to make a vehicle that's capable of beating the opposition. And the two drivers' setups rarely deviated from one another, because there's basically fear, I think, that they would, if they took a different direction on setup and actually made it worse, then the other guy would get an advantage. So they were both... We were just tweaking little things on setup. It wasn't any big changes, and all they were doing was looking across the garage at what the other guy was doing. So it was very different.
You said a minute ago that Prost was more interested in having a good car for the race, but I did want to ask you about Portugal 88, where he was mighty, mighty in qualifying. And tell me if I'm wrong, but I think he got changed into his jeans mid-qualifying and then stood on the pit wall just to annoy Senna. Is that true?
That's absolutely true, yeah. He was phenomenally quick, and literally, I think, half an hour into the session, he went off to the truck, got changed into his civvies, and just leant on the pit wall looking into Ayrton's garage. And
Beat that, which of course he didn't. But how good was that lap? Why was Prost so mighty that day?
On his day, Alan could be very, very quick, but I think also Ayrton had a slight problem with his engine settings, so there may have been a slight detriment to the performance of Ayrton's car, which helped, because there was a reasonable difference in Jerez as well, but nothing like as it was in Portugal. Yeah, and I think he just wanted to sort of touch his nose against Ayrton. And,
Early in the race, Senna veers towards the pit wall with Prost on his right-hand side, almost putting Alan into the wall. Was that the first time you saw anything particularly aggressive between those two?
Yeah, I think it was, to be honest. It may have been partly as a result of what Alan did on the previous afternoon, to be honest. And yeah, I think I'd been pretty amicable, yeah, up to that point. And then that did create a little bit of tension, which obviously then bubbled over 6 months later in Imola. Yeah.
Do you think that was the first time it got awkward? And that
I think so, yeah.
Okay. And was Ron good at dealing with those two in those situations?
He was. I think that was a major part of his working day. He was pacifying, keeping them both happy and performing well. It's something he sheltered the rest of the team from very well, in fact. And so we weren't really that bothered. But obviously it did get a little bit more tense in 89. And I think from him onwards, the drivers just didn't speak to each other.
So how did it work in the debriefs?
Slightly weirdly. I mean, we'd be sitting around the table like we are now, all of us. Both drivers, myself, Steve and Gordon and Tim Wright. But the drivers would never speak to each other. If Alan wanted to know something about Ayrton's car, he'd ask Steve. And if Ayrton wanted to know something, he'd ask me and not Alan. So it's a slightly strange situation, but not really any animosity evident in that situation.
And incredibly secretive, not wanting to give away anything about performance to the other one?
No, it was actually fairly open. I think, as I mentioned earlier, that the setups didn't really vary very much, because they only really had to worry about the guy on the other side of the table. So, yeah, it was fairly open and there wasn't really anything underhand.
Do you think Prost accepted that Senna was quicker than him over one lap?
Never asked him that question, but I think my gut feeling is yes, but it didn't really bother him. And obviously they were half a generation apart, so Alan had done his bit and was a lot further in his career. And Ayrton wanted to prove that he was the fastest driver ever, probably. But it's not something that really played on Alan's mind, I don't think.
How much did Senna winning that title in 88 play on Prost's mind?
I wasn't actually at those last couple of races in 88 because I was working on the race car for the following year. So the immediate aftermath of it, I'm not sure. On balance, over the whole of 88, Ayrton probably did have the upper hand over Alan. He obviously had a couple of reliability problems, which cost him perhaps more than Alan lost through failures. And in the race in 88, Alan had a problem with his gearbox, so he was struggling a little bit. And Ayrton was obviously on top form that day, as he normally was.
Yeah, he was blistering. So he wins the title in 88, Senna does. We come into 89, your car, MP45, Honda, because the regulations changed, the turbo's gone, a V10 comes in. How good was the engine, first of all?
It was pretty good. It obviously we've done quite a lot of testing over the 6 months in the second half of 88, so the reliability was good, and it was very strong. It was probably the best engine in the field.
Really, from day one?
Certainly from the beginning of the racing season, so that was an advantage for us.
Is it true that McLaren sent a chassis to Suzuka and the likes of Alan McNish and Emanuele Pirro were pounding round Suzuka with the V10?
Oh yeah, and the turbo as well previously. So as soon as we signed the contract with Honda, we'd effectively had a test team in Japan for all the years of the Honda contract. And so it was running perhaps once a month, roughly, or every 6 weeks. So you know, they probably do 8-10 tests there a year on all the engines. So they'd be running development for the current year and for next year as well, which was, again, a big advantage for the engine side of us. It wasn't a huge benefit from the chassis side, but for the engine, it was performance, reliability, etc. was a good thing to have available to us.
So the engine's good. The car is clearly good because you win lots of races. But how did you feel personally coming into 1989 on the back of such a hugely successful season? This is your baby, Neil. Did you feel pressure?
Oh, a tremendous amount. I mean, not because anyone was putting it on me, but within myself, I thought, how the hell am I going to repeat what we did last year? And obviously, it all came crashing down in the first race because Ayrton had an accident on the first or second corner. Alan had a problem with the clutch hydraulic pipe. It had broken away from its mounting and was lying on the exhaust pipe, so it boiled all the clutch fluid, so we effectively didn't have a clutch. And even in those days, when tyre deg wasn't so huge, Brazil was, because of the sort of nature of the tarmac, which had lots of seashells in it, I think, was very abrasive, and we got high deg, so even then you had to do a one or two stop race, which was unusual for that period in time. And as tyres were, you know, going off and off, and we kept screaming on the radio to come in with what we planned to do, was just track the car up, give it a boot full of revs, and we just drop it off the jack so we could take it off. But he didn't believe that would work, so he just refused to come in, so he just did the whole race on one set of the tyres. So we obviously dropped down a few positions. He should have won if the clutch had been working, but we didn't. So,
and of course, Nigel Mansell completes his first race distance in that Ferrari to win the race. But you must have been confident, though. You'd seen enough performance from the car in that race.
We did. Obviously, the Ferrari was reasonably competitive as well. As you say, it had a lot of reliability problems, but they obviously come on top of those. So on some circuits, they were good, but not consistently. Williams was good again on some circuits, but not others. So I think our car was reasonably good for most locations that we raced on that year.
And after Imola, after the deal that they weren't going to overtake each other before the first corner, and Prost felt that Senna had overtaken him unfairly.
Yeah, I think there was a lack of agreement as to whether Tosser was the first corner or... or a Tamburello, or the one that comes after that, I can't remember what it's called, or Villeneuve, I think. And so that was really the...
Did you ever worry that when they started to not talk to each other and their relationship became an issue, did you worry that this rivalry could end up losing you the championship?
Not really, because I think they both behaved themselves on the circuit. Obviously, Pat Suzuka was a slight negative to that comment, but...
during the race, and that means to say that Prost has won the world championship. Alain Prost, world champion of 1989.
The problem with Ayrton, he can't accept not to win, and he can't accept that somebody resists by an overtaking manoeuvre. And I learned a lot this year, especially on the human side. But to be very honest, I mean, I'm quite happy to leave, because I think it becomes absolutely impossible to work with Ayrton, and that's a good end of championship.
So Suzuka, they're coming into the chicane. If you haven't seen it, have a look on YouTube. And Senna dives down the inside of Alain to try and go for the lead of the race. And they end up colliding, Prost's out of the race, etc. What happened after the race there in terms of what internally? What were people at McLaren thinking about that accident?
Yeah, I think to be honest, probably I was an exception because I was working on his car. But I think the team, as I mentioned earlier, that sort of migrated across the garage to Ayrton's side, really. And obviously there was a lot of legal wranglings with the FIA and such like after that, and whether Eden should have been disqualified or not. And the team are trying very hard to make sure that Eden got that win back. I think directly after the race, I can't remember if I actually saw him, because he didn't come back to the garage immediately. He went off to the FIA stewards and was there for a long time. And obviously, we were off to the airport fairly soon after the race. So I don't think I actually saw him probably even until we got to Adelaide. But yeah, I think the team really wanted Ayrton to win and carry the number one plate
and
the next year. Yeah.
By this time in the season, you knew that Prost was off to Ferrari as well. I'm guessing that that's the worst place that he could have gone in the eyes of Ron Dennis, at least.
That's a pretty true comment. Yeah. And obviously, Ferrari are very strong and they were always a big rival to us. So,
did you think of joining Alla in Maranello? I know Steve Nichols went with him. Did he try and take you as well?
He did mention it to me, but I didn't really have the appetite to do that. I mean, I was very happy within the McLaren organisation and thought ultimately we would do a better job than Maranello would.
Well, as it panned out. But what must have been a really interesting journey for you is that you went from working with Prost, of course, still in the design office, you're still designing the cars, but in terms of what's happening at the racetrack, you then jump onto Senna's side of the garage. How welcoming was Ayrton?
Ayrton was always very friendly, and I don't think he viewed me as a real enemy. And he was just on the driver level. I think perhaps that.
Oh, even when Alan was at the team,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
And how different was it working with Senna?
Fair bit. I mean, obviously, I'd done testing with him previously, but not races, and he was a lot more intense. He's playing over setups with the car and also the engine. He was taking things to a different level compared to what Alan had been used to. I mean, Alan was still in the mode where he'd, on a sort of Saturday afternoon, after qualifying, he'd 2 hours later, he'd be off in the golf course with Jacques Lafitte, whereas Ayrton would be locked in the truck with the Honda engineers trying to work out how he could make the engine response better or more drivable, etc. So it just started to bring things into a different level.
Is it true that his power of recall was incredible?
Very much so. I think like a lot of really top drivers, they drive incredibly quickly, but still have a large percentage of their brain available to think about what they're doing and how they can make the car faster and what it was doing at every moment on the circuit. I think that perhaps came to a fore with the active ride car in 93, where we could tune it almost yard by yard to suit the different attitudes that the car was taking in different corners, high speed, low speed, etc. And
interesting that you mentioned that 93 car, because the Formula One folklore would have you believe that the FW15C, the Williams of that year, was the most sophisticated car in the history of Formula One, etc., etc. But your active ride on that McLaren, I read somewhere that you designed it in 2 or 3 months. Is that true? And how good was that car by the end of that year?
Yeah, it was what you say on the timescale is absolutely true. And in fact, I think that year, Ron was convinced that Honda could be persuaded to carry on racing. So we got to October and we honestly didn't know what engine we were going to fit in the car. So we were designing it, not knowing whether it's going to be a V8, V10 or V12. And the Cosworth deal, the full deal, was done, I think, by the end of October. Fortunately, Cosworth had given us a few drawings that we could start working on just prior to that. But that was one thing. And we'd had an active ride project with Honda running for a couple of years, but it was incredibly complicated, more akin to the Lotus and Williams systems. Then that disappeared. So we had to do something quickly. And what we went for was just an active ride height control system, which was very, very simple. Pat Fry and Giorgio Ascanelli worked on that, and as you say, it came together in 2 to 3 months and was just ready in time to run on the car when it first ran at Silverstone at the beginning of 93.
And you honed it, and do you think in the second half of 93 you had the best car on the grid?
Yeah, I think we won a couple of races in slightly unusual weather conditions at the beginning of the year, but the car was still reasonably competitive, but it was still quite a lot slower than the Williams. I mean, at Donington, it was a second half, 2 seconds off the pace in qualifying, but a bit better in the race. But we still had a valve spring Ford engine until the race after Hockenheim, and then we had the pneumatic valve spring engine, so that was quite a big step forward. But we kept tuning the chassis. The suspension system got more and more the components were still very much the same, but how we used it became more complex. In Monza, we added power brakes, which was fairly novel, and that made quite a big difference to our performance. So I think by the time we got to the last couple of races in Japan and Australia, the car was as good as anything else on the grid, but the whole grid has all closed up quite a bit by that time.
How did Senna react to all of the developments you put on that car? Because, you know, perhaps the fastest driver on the grid would want it to be as basic as possible, the formula, I mean, for him to show his brilliance. Did he welcome these developments or did he push?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And he loved playing with the suspension system with Pat and Giorgio and honing it to suit what he wanted the car to do at any moment on the circuit. So he used to spend hours working with it.
The debriefs got even longer.
And then they spent hours and hours afterwards. And I think he loved all that.
So loved it, but do you think he thought Formula One was going in the wrong direction in terms of driver aids?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it depended on what other people had. that's one downside is that different teams could accelerate their developments in different areas. Perhaps traction control he wasn't so keen on if that was more of a direct driver responsibility, if you like. And we also had the Lambo engine that year as well to play with
that.
As well.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Gosh, there was a lot going on at McLaren that time, wasn't there? Have you seen, Neil, a better opening lap of a Grand Prix than Senna at Donington in 93?
No, that was pretty special. As I mentioned just now, we were some way off the pace in qualifying, but the rain's quite a good equaliser. It sort of nullifies some of the Renault advantage that Williams had at that time. And probably our suspension system, because it was a lot simpler, suited those conditions better, and it could give the driver more feel, more feedback from the circuit of what the car was capable of doing. I mean, it was quite wet on that lap. I mean, I think the sun was actually shining on the grid, but then it started to rain, and I think everyone was a bit unsure of the actual grip level they had. But Ayrton sussed it out a lot better than most of the other drivers.
And of all the drivers you've worked with in your career, give me your top three.
Yeah, certainly Ayrton and Alan were exceptional. I think Mika, I think, is a little bit underrated in global terms. I think he was an exceptionally talented driver.
Well, and he came in Portugal 93, first race for the team, out-qualified Senna. I mean, what a wake-up call for Ayrton Senna, among many other things.
Yeah, I don't think Ayrton was too impressed. but in the race, he got his own back, and I think he sort of made sure that it didn't happen again in the remaining two races of the year as well.
But what stood out about Häkkinen? It's really interesting you mention him. His raw speed.
Yeah, is that the ability to drive a car quickly, but obviously in a Formula One, that's not the only attribute you need to have. But he was incredibly receptive to different ideas to help him drive quicker. If we sort of go ahead a few years, for instance, the brake steer system, and he absolutely loved that. And I think, being realistic, if David had been our only driver, that he would never actually got past the first test. But Mika was able to just adapt his driving to suit the tools that you've given him.
So this is 1997, and there was an extra brake pedal in the footwell, wasn't there? Just very quickly explain what it did.
Yeah, in that year, the extra pedal, it was a Steve Nichols' idea, which I think he had lying in the bath one day. and it was connected to one or other of the rear brake calipers, depending on where the predominant corners were on any particular circuit. So that basically allowed you to, once you come on the throttle, you could stamp on that pedal and it helped the car turn. So if you had you could set the car up with a sort of tendency to understeer, but that would overcome the understeer. So you could much better some mid-corner to exit speed, and if you're trying to sort of fight an aero balance and make the car quick, so it's incredibly effective.
So around a track like Silverstone, what was it worth in terms of lap time?
We only tested it at Silverstone, so we never really did a back-to-back, but I guess feeling was it was probably worth 3 tenths when we first did it. It may have grown to 5 or 6 tenths as we got more used to it. And for the beginning of the following year, we developed an arrangement where you could switch it from one side to the other, so it actually meant you could use it on every corner rather than just one hand of corner, which we had in Melbourne. And then it was sort of knocked on the head on Thursday afternoon in Brazil, so that was the end of it. But although we didn't suddenly go backwards on the grid when we took it off.
But and Häkkinen would welcome those innovations.
yeah, I mean, sort of hand clutches and such like, which we'd been playing with, and you know, he loved doing something different, and so he could left foot break more easily, as David didn't like left foot breaking. It took a long time to wean him often to using both feet instead of just his right foot.
With Häkkinen, did you notice any difference in terms of what he was capable of doing in a car pre and post his accident at Adelaide in 95?
No, to be honest. It was fairly invisible. I mean, it was a fairly serious incident, and he was quite gravely injured, and obviously he was fairly lucky to survive, I think, in reality. Ron did a fantastic job at keeping him in cotton wool and slowly bringing him back into a position where he was fit and able to drive the car. And it was a very low-key test we did with him at Rickard, just to make sure he could get back to his old self. And I think that was fairly evident almost straight away that nothing had really changed. And then once we started testing properly, he was on it straight away. So no.
He's such an inspirational character, isn't he? Even now, I love seeing him around the paddock.
Yeah, he was a super nice guy. I was a good human being, but he was a fantastic racer.
And in Miami this year, just seeing him talking to Jeff Bezos, Mika was charged with showing Jeff Bezos around the paddock, you know, the Amazon boss. And I was watching him, and he was enthusing so much about Formula One. So he's been involved in F1 as a driver, is he now an ambassador, and he still really loves it.
Yeah, I don't think he was ever a really sort of technical person, but he just loved the thrill and driving a racing car and being able to maximise what he could personally get out of it and relaying that back to the engineers to move on to the next step or help him to go that little bit quicker.
How much does it help you as an engineer to have a driver with a technical bent? I mean, is it helpful if they start meddling with what to do with the car, or do you actually just want basic feedback, leave the technical stuff to us?
Probably the latter. I mean, it's not something I'm particularly directly involved in or haven't been for some time now, but I think a driver just reporting what's happening and not trying to engineer the car himself is always preferable, I think, to any race engineer or designer. Yeah.
Now, Neil, I've had you for so much time. It's been wonderful to talk to you. I did want to just run a couple more things past you. One is that I know some people listening to this will be fans of the DRS. The drag reduction system. There will be some people who are not fans of it saying it's a gimmick and gosh, I wish it hadn't been introduced. And I think, Neil, tell me if I'm wrong, that the sport has McLaren to thank for the DRS system. And it all goes back to the F-duct of 2010. Look, tell us about the F-duct. What was it? Because of course, the following year, the DRS system was introduced by the FIA. But how innovative was that F-duct?
Very. I mean, that came out of the blue. I mean, I think in the aero department, we've got a mad scientist who completely fits the bill, if you were trying to think what that would might be. But he came up with the idea, and it was a fairly complex system. I think obviously a lot of people did similar things during that season, but I don't think anyone actually twigged what we were actually doing with it. And it was very effective, and I think it's worth 15 k's on the straight.
So stalling the rear wing, is that?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah. So as you say, it was very similar to, in end result, to what DRS did and is still doing. But it was a great advantage for that car, and obviously, unlike DRS, we could use it everywhere that we wanted to, and it was very safe because it was a driver's elbow operating it, and it was very simple. I don't think we ever had any instances where they forgot about it and accidentally triggered it, yeah.
Do you think, in all your experience, that so often, Formula One, at least from the outside, looks an incredibly complicated sport, but is it invariably the simple ideas that are often the most effective?
I think so. You say it's a very technical sport, but you still rely on the ingenuity of individuals to think of things that nobody else has done and gives you an advantage. And it's fantastic when it does happen.
And of course, Lewis Hamilton was driving for you when the F-duct was on the car. Lots of fans of Lewis out there listening to this. How much did he love the technical side and welcoming new ideas like an F-duct?
Making use of any tools you give him. Lewis was very, very quick at being able to exploit them very well. We had the F-duct on the car almost right from the get-go on that car in testing, but it, it was a bit troublesome to get it to work properly initially. So there were a lot of late nights in Barcelona trying to get the thing working properly. But once it worked, which was obviously prior to the first race, it was fantastic. So there were some great engineers working on it, very practical people, and the driver being able to exploit it properly. But I think, you know, it's a fairly straightforward thing. If you can suddenly get 15 k's on the straights, you're not going to turn that down very easily.
And what impressed you about Lewis, just as a driver? Was it his sheer speed? Was it his ability to think of everything whilst driving?
I mean, his sheer speed was fairly evident. I mean, he obviously had a couple of years in the sort of junior formula with us just prior to that, and done acceptably well. I mean, there were a few events where he'd made mistakes and ended up in midfield and was able to just overtake everybody. So his talent was fairly obvious right from the word go. I still don't think there was a complete conviction that he was ready for Formula One when we signed him, but it almost was a sort of force majeure situation. So he joined us, and also I don't think anyone quite expected him to be so instantly competitive.
Nice start by both the McLarens. Look at Kubica attacking Hamilton. We've got yellow flags at the back. Hamilton's had some manners put on him by Kubica, but he comes round the outside. He's also got round Alonso. Stunning start by Lewis Hamilton up into third place. Raikkonen pulls away. Heidfeld's after him. Alonso now has to get past Hamilton. What an amazingly composed start by Lewis Hamilton.
Going round the outside of Fernando Alonso in the first race.
Yeah, and he was effectively as quick as Fernando, really, from Melbourne onwards. And I think Fernando was one of those key figures that didn't expect to see that, unfortunately. Yeah.
And do you think there were these intra-team rivalries, Jones-Reutemann, Senna-Prost, Alonso-Hamilton? Is there a common link to all of it? Is it just competitiveness? Is that actually the cause of all those problems? Sheer will to win?
I think so. There's slightly different reasons for all those cases that you just mentioned. With Lewis, I mean, he was the new kid on the block, but I think the only animosity grew out of the competitive situation between them. And I think Fernando was certainly expecting Lewis to play second fiddle, and Lewis wasn't interested in doing that.
It was an incredible year. You've had so many incredible years in your career. When you look back at it all, Neil, what was the most enjoyable period for you?
I think they've all been enjoyable for different reasons, but I mean, the early years at Williams were very good just because I was just learning the trade, and it went from a back end of the grid team to a front end of the grid team in such a short space of time. Coming to McLaren, it was a whole different setup, and that's evolved so much. I mean, it's a very different team now than it was years ago in sort of 86, so they're all good periods, but for different reasons. Yeah, obviously the last few years haven't been the best for us, but still there's a fantastic group of people here too that we're hoping to sort of let off the leash, get their confidence back, and some really pull us through into a more competitive position during the season.
Bringing it up to the here and now, you know, the wind tunnel is about to come on stream. The new technical regime, when David Sanchez comes on board at the end of the year, is about to hit the ground running. I mean, do you feel this is an exciting time for McLaren now? Does it remind you of another period where you were just about to go boom and blossom?
I think so. I think everyone's very, very excited about moving forward from where we are. We've been in some dark times in the recent past, not least in Miami, but the confidence is coming back to everybody. People aren't worried about making mistakes. We're trying to encourage all the younger guys to use their talent, which is fairly obvious, but in a way that's more productive to the team, and have belief in their own abilities because they're all fantastic people.
And it's now a good time to be an engineer in Formula One, because it seems to me that all the teams are now making money. So suddenly, there aren't just four teams with the potential to lure a big engineer somewhere. There are lots of opportunities now up and down the grid.
Yeah, there's a tremendous amount. I mean, all the teams have got very large engineering departments. And I think as we started off the conversation, Williams had two, which was a fantastic way to learn, because by default, you had to get involved in everything on the car, which is someone joining today tends to get specialised very early in their career. We do try to move people around in different roles, but that's not always that straightforward to do. In some ways, it's difficult for the guys coming in now to get that experience in different areas. But
do you think that's important?
I think so, yeah.
What, just to get a perspective on what the whole car is doing, even if your expertise is gearboxes.
Yeah, I mean, they're all, basically they're all engineers, so you ought to be able to turn your hand to any aspect of engineering and still make a good job of it. But having those different inputs directly to you rather than bothering secondhand, I think is a great advantage. So the more we can do that, I think the better for everybody and the better the team will be.
Exciting times ahead for McLaren. They're very lucky to still have you, Neil, and thank you very much for your time. It's been great to chat.
A pleasure to talk to you.
What great advice. I can't think of a better mentor for young engineers. Neil is one of those people whom I could have spoken to all day. He's lived at the cutting edge of F1 design for more than 45 years. He's worked with some of the most inspirational designers and drivers that the sport has ever seen. And I loved his descriptions of life with Senna, Prost and Hakkinen in particular. It felt like he took us into a debrief with Senna and Prost, discussing the performance of the McLaren MP4-5. Neil, many thanks for your time. I really enjoyed our chat and I hope to see you again soon. Now, please send in your thoughts and stories about Neil. Were you at Silverstone in 79 when Regger took Williams' first win while being engineered by Neil? What are your memories of the Senna-Prost era? Let me know through all the usual means. I'm at TomClarksonF1 on Twitter or use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid. Which brings me on to what you sent in about Logan Sargeant after last week's show. Many of you have been impressed by the young American's speed this year. Let's start with this from Michael Cruikshank. I loved listening to the Logan Sargeant podcast. I was working at Pirelli during his F3 season with Prema. It was great to watch him and Oscar Piastri, both great to watch and amazingly quick, and both great guys. I love the fact, Michael, that Logan and Oscar's careers have crossed paths so much. And you're right, there was very little to separate them in F3. Next, let's hear from Lisa Carter Garcia. I love the chat with Logan, she says. I enjoyed listening to details about his career trajectory and hope he accomplishes all his goals with Williams this year. I can't wait to chant USA when we see him during the driver's parade in Vegas. Yes, Lisa, get that crowd going in Vegas, and thank you for your message. And what about this from Neil East? I've been a fan of Logan's since he pushed Piastri to the limit in that F3 championship. Honestly, if he can start stringing weekends together, I think he'll have a bright future in Formula One. Well, I completely agree, Neil, as does Williams team principal James Vowles, who said pretty much the same thing as you. So well done. And finally, let's hear from Cam N. I really like Logan's attitude. He seems to be talented, humble, and willing to learn. I hope to see more of him. Thanks, Cam, and I'm with you on that. Now, we're going to leave it there for this week. Thanks to everyone who wrote in. And even if I haven't had time to read out your message here, I have read it. And please remember to send in your thoughts and stories about Neil Oatley in time for next week's show. Well, that's pretty much it from me this week. In other news, our F1 Nation review of the 2023 Spanish Grand Prix is out now. We reflect on another dominant display from Max Verstappen and whether Mercedes are finally heading in the right direction after a double podium in Barcelona. And this week's episode of Formula Y asks, why do Formula One teams need simulators? With input from Aston Martin, Alpine and Red Bull. That's available from Friday, and just search F1 Nation and Formula Y in your podcast app. But that's it from me. Thank you very much for listening. I'll be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.